Good morning. I'm going to do something a little different. I'm actually going to move over here. I would much rather you guys see that instead of look at me. Just my preference. So you guys have a chance to sacrifice and love my preferences more. Also, need a coffee holder. If you don't know, I'm also over coffee ministry for Faith Community Church. So if you're a beneficiary of Kingsgate Coffee, one, thank you. I'm glad that you guys are enjoying it, but it gives me a chance to actually be even more about my preferences and choose which coffee to do, choose which creamers to buy. And so I will take suggestions for creamers. I just don't do anything with your suggestions. So just saying, it's just not my thing. Once you open that door, someone's like, I really am into salted caramel, oat milk, half and half, whatever. I just put an end to that right away. I'm like, thank you so much. That is a great idea. And then I just don't do anything with it. So can you guys hear me? Do I make this? There we go. Well, I appreciate Richard allowing me the chance to come and teach. This might be my last opportunity to teach with you guys. Depends on the report that people say afterwards. But there's a reason they put me in youth ministry and college group. I do enjoy it very much. In fact, I see a handful of faces in here of former students that I've taught, and so I'm excited to be here and really teach you guys this morning. Now, when I was trying to decide what I was going to teach on for a one-off lesson, there's a moment of like, man, I could just be really mean. And college group, we've started 2 Corinthians. I hear that you guys are on like part like 300 on 1 Corinthians, and so. But, you know, I didn't want to spoil the ending of 1 Corinthians by starting 2 Corinthians. So, what I decided to do instead is do, really, it's a session that I did for a youth group this past summer. And I'm going to really, it's a culmination of all of it together for our lesson this morning. And really, it's answering this question. The largest worldview among youth and young adults. The largest worldview among youth and young adults. Now, I would argue this specifically talking about in Western society. I would say this is a problem definitely in America, for sure. The Cultural Research Center, which has done lots of studies, particularly with Christianity and just looking into different worldviews, they say, as of a study 2 years ago, only 6% of U.S. adults hold to a biblical worldview. 6%. A new piece of groundbreaking research by the Cultural Research Center answers the question raised by the initial study. If American adults do not have a biblical worldview, then what is the dominant worldview among the other 94%? Well, what's really interesting is as they did this study, they found that the answer to this was there was no answer. Well, let me explain what I mean by that. Based on about an hour and a half long personal interviews with about 2,000 youth and young adults, the CRC study found that the most common worldview might best be described as syncretism. Now, don't write this down because this is not the name that stuck. Really, all this is just saying is, as they started doing more study, they found that what they believed was kind of a melting pot, a mesh of a bunch of different worldviews all smushed together that didn't really check any particular box. It was a summary of random, irreconcilable collection of beliefs, behaviors that define people's lives. Almost like a cut-and-paste approach to making sense and their response to life, rather than developing an internal, consistent, philosophical, coherent perspective on life, Americans embrace points of view or actions that feel comfortable, and this is more important, convenient. They have developed worldviews that have become convenient with the way they live. Those beliefs and behaviors are often inconsistent or even contradictory to one another, but even pointing out to them that their beliefs are contradictory to one another means nothing to them. Because as long as it fits them and their life, they're completely content with that. When compiling the answers to various questions, what they ended up doing is taking those answers and putting it almost into a machine. And this machine would take all the information and spit out the worldview that these people would have. And they really just wanted to see what was the closest one that it came to, so they didn't have to call it syncretism. And what they found is when it came out with the answer was none of the above. It wouldn't even match consistently to another worldview. And so what they did, and this was a study that was done probably about 15 years ago when this term was coined, but what they've coined it as is moralistic therapeutic deism. Now, raise your hand if you've heard of moral... Now, hold on. If you're in the youth, you literally just heard this summer, okay? No, you can raise your hand. That's fine. It makes it look better. Who's actually heard of this before? Okay. Yeah, this is not like a brand new study in that sense, but I definitely wanted to take the time this summer to kind of walk through this with our young people, but specifically the high school students, so that they would understand, one, this is the world they're growing up in. Two, as they start developing friendships in college and relationships with coworkers, this is kind of at least giving them a level playing field on how to interact and how other people are thinking. But really more so is Faith Community Church is not immune to this either. And just in the interactions I've had with many young people in our college group and our youth group, this is a prevalent problem where they have learned how to be moralistic. They've learned to believe in God in some sense, but ultimately the middle word there is defining everything, and it's all about their own happiness. It's all about their own happiness. And so really what they found is a total of 9 out of 10 U.S. teens really have an impure, unrecognizable worldview that is a blending of ideas and multiple perspectives. And really, if you wanted to read more on this, you could read Soul Searching. This is by, I think, Christian Smith. It's The Religious and Spiritual Lives of American Teens. If you want a little shorter volume, there's a book called God, Happiness, and the American Faith. I think the name is Benjamin. I'm not remembering his first name off the top of my head. But that was written in 2023, so just last year. But if you want to do more research, but just to show you, again, where we're at for MTD, I'm going to refer to it as MTD so I don't have to, double the length of this message by saying the words over and over. So MTD, you can see based on a study, this was a study done in 2021 by Arizona Christian University. This is all the worldviews that are outside of a biblical worldview. Can y'all see? That was another reason why I sat over here. Biblical worldview is up there, but they've got secular humanism, postmodernism, nihilism, Eastern mysticism, Marxism. But at the very top is moralistic therapeutic deism, which is interesting. But if you really look at what our climate has been over the last, I would say, 15 to 20 years, it's really not all that surprising. Because again, what I would call this worldview, it's a convenient, lazy worldview. And that's what we're seeing with our young people just in the culture that we are in today. When adding the worldview of MTD, it turns out many answers and responses correlated to this worldview and thus make it the highest percentage according to the study in 2021. In their study, they found that those who hold to MTD usually interlocked into other categories in our world. Those categories being spiritual skeptics, LGBTQ supporters, political liberals, individuals who attend predominantly black or predominantly Catholic churches are most common to adhere to this worldview. But the question is, where did it stem from? Where did this originate? Barna, in his study, says this: worldviews in America develop organically. Very few schools have teaching that focuses directly on a person's worldview. Very few adults know what a worldview is, much less what the worldview alternatives are or how they differ. and which one they possess. We have been shocked at how few Christian schools, as well as religious congregations, directly address worldview. I'm very thankful for many of the schools that are even represented in this room that I know address worldview, because it is so important to understand how we think and then how to approach really life through that biblical lens. And really, to sum it up, Barna said this: ultimately, if you want to know where it came from, worldviews are not taught, they're caught like a cold. Depending on your context and where you grow up and how you think. And I'll say that even among our own teens, Faith Community Church or any other like-minded church in our circle, this is becoming more and more prevalent. And so the question needs to be asked, why aren't young people leaving youth group with a more biblical worldview? Again, one author says this: knowing a few Bible verses, attending church services, and praying won't get the job done. Attending a Christian school that offers a chapel service and a Bible class won't accomplish the task. Going to church services that feature sermons drawn from biblical content is not sufficient to build a biblical worldview. Parents expecting their children to follow the Ten Commandments is not enough to develop a full-scale biblical worldview. All of those are token efforts that have proven inadequate towards developing an integrated body of beliefs and behaviors that enable someone to think like Jesus so they can then live like Jesus. And what's really at the core of many of the people who would fall underneath the categories I just read is a weak soteriology. It's a weak understanding of salvation, because you cannot simply add more religious things into the life of our children and expect them to grow up and be saved. It is always the will of the Father that opens the eyes of our children. Now, that doesn't mean that we say, well, fine, hands off, let's see what the Lord does. No, there's a responsibility as parents to do this and as schools to do this. But where is our hope when it comes in those things? He goes on to say that our studies show that Americans have neither deep nor sophisticated thinkers. Americans have become selfish, they have become emotion-driven, and leaving logic behind. To promote a way of life that pushes us to think more clearly, consistently, and purposefully will take time and effort, and, this is even more important, to get to that point is uncomfortable for young people. Most people seem more interested in living a life of comfort and convenience than one of logical consistency and wisdom. I literally just seeing a post recently about the things of nightmares of young people today. And towards the top of that was simply having to order something over the phone. I'll admit, can be terrifying. I'd much rather just click on a few things on Amazon. But that's the state of our young people today, is they're terrified of a verbal conversation. And by the way, young people in this room, don't take any offense. I know you guys don't fall underneath any of these categories. You guys are all doing great, except for you. So let's kind of talk about this so that we can understand this even better. I would, again, summarize this as a lazy, self-centered, and convenient worldview that is known as moralistic therapeutic deism. Now, let me say a couple qualifiers just to help you understand. This is by no means a sect of Christianity. I would say that people who are Catholic, Buddhist, Judaism would all fall underneath this category of being a moralistic therapeutic deist. Because all you have to do is believe in right and wrong, believe in a higher intelligence, and then chase after your own happiness. And so many, even within the Islam faith, which is rapidly growing, young people in Western society are falling underneath this category. I would not say this is a denomination. There's not an MTD church around the corner. They don't meet in a building. This is simply a worldview that's among every single, I would say, denomination and religion today. And I would say if you wanted to find out if someone was an MTD, if someone actually had that worldview, it's not something that you could do just by asking. You would have to see how they read and see how they pray. You would have to ask them to explain their devotion to God. How do they plan for the future? How do they react to hardship and difficulty? How do they live in the different spheres of life, like work, school, and family? And then more importantly, how do they respond to sin, especially when they're called out? In these things, what it reveals is the false religion of MTD and what one writer coined as low-cost Christianity. That's a great way of defining it, low-cost Christianity. You get all the benefits of wearing your cross necklace, but never having to pick up your own cross and follow after him. Now, I wanted to just take time this morning. We're not going to do a full study of really the subject, but I just want to tell you, one is looking at the MTD specifically, and then I think it was Benjamin that put together a group of five doctrinal creeds of someone that's MTD, and so we'll briefly look at that. But then I really wanted to end with, what's our response as the church for someone that's holding to MTD? First, let's just kind of look at this very quickly. We're going to look at why moralistic, why therapeutic, why deism. First, we have to understand what a moralist is. Morals are simply defined as they're concerned with principles of right and wrong behavior and the goodness or badness of human character. Someone that lives a life of goodness and rightness, mostly in the public sphere, I would say that that's a very important qualifier, is that it would be in the public sphere, because reality is someone that is a moralist to heart doesn't have the capability of being a good person in the private areas of their life because they're a slave to their sin. The problem, of course, that you can foresee is if you're going to figure out what it, you know, is it wrong to be a moralist? Is, I think in general, is it wrong to be, you know, trying to do what's right? No. But the question is, who gets to define what's right and what's wrong? Because what's unfortunate today is people may start off with a sense of right and wrong, but more and more people, if you were to ask them and really press in, what is the source of your good and your evil that you define your terms to? They would mostly say their conscience. And if you were to really press in, like, well, what does that even mean? Really, when they're backed against the wall, the only answer they have left to say is, well, it just feels right. It just feels wrong. And of course, if that's the end result of anyone's decisions on what's right and what's wrong, man, we are in a mess right now. And many of us get to see this in our workplaces and with our extended families. And what happens is you end up with their version of God defining what's right and what's wrong. Government defines right and wrong. Your community, the internet, and ultimately self defines what's right and what's wrong. One author again says that MTD believes that central to living a good and happy life is being a good moral person. That means being nice, being kind, being pleasant, being respectful, being responsible, working on self-improvement, taking care of one's health, and doing one's best to be successful. Is that not the American dream that we're living in? Being moral in this faith means being the kind of person who other people like, fulfilling one's personal potential, and not being socially disruptive or, I like this one, interpersonally obnoxious. That's our goal in according to moralism. Just don't be a jerk. Can you do that? Can you just get up every day and just not be obnoxious? Or what's the other perverse? Just stay in your lane. If we can just stay in our lane, not only are we doing well, but according to MTD, God thinks you're doing well. But again, the problem, and this is what I told the young people, is if this was the end goal, is just to stay in our lane, then what does parenting look like? I mean, that's impossible. To stay in your lane as a parent? No, because their car is going all over the lanes, and sometimes literally, depending on how old the kid is. And so we have to actually step in, and we have to give guidance, which means that it requires us to go above simply right and wrong according to self. And I would say this, it's about how you do good and why you do good. How you do good and why you do good. Ultimately, we should stand up for what's right. We should praise those who do good. Just because we see a young child trying to do the right thing, we don't sit there and like, don't be a moralist. I don't think that's helpful. I don't think that's the direction we need to go. But again, we're talking about it all the time. Why is that right? We're opening to the scriptures and we're pointing to the reasons that it's right. And we're always keeping into the back of their mind that some of the most morally good people of the Bible, the Pharisees, would have fit perfectly into this category. And yet they were like dead men's bones, wasting away in their heart. We got to remind them that it's always according to scripture. It's always according to the Spirit of God. And it's always dependent on his strength and not ours. And I would say that's the biggest issue with moralism in general, is it's all about our own strength instead of relying on the Lord. To answer why, it's an offering of thanks for God for the mercy that he gives to us in our life. Ultimately knowing that we will never be good enough to earn salvation, to earn his grace. But that's the point of grace, is that we're never meant to gain it. And so for young people that are sucked into a moralistic mindset, it's telling them, just looking at them point blank and saying, you will never earn your way to salvation. Because ultimately what we do is we don't live for self-improvement. We live to deny ourselves and to be slaves of Christ, because we are owned by him. In its concern for moral fairness, MTD resembles what one sociologist calls golden rule Christianity, a theological fuzzy form of Christianity that honors moral practices more than specific beliefs and following through in the private areas of our life. They love the practice of God's law rather than worshiping the lawgiver himself. Now I would say it's man-centered, driven by fear of man, wanting the praise of man, and it's all about perceived goodness. You don't care about genuine goodness. You don't care about what the ingredients are in the package, you could say. What you care about is how it's perceived. Is that not a common temptation in our own hearts in the church? To walk in on a Sunday morning and want the perceived goodness that comes, the perceived morals? It's a constant battle for me. Maybe I'm the only one. But how much more so do we desperately need to worship the Lord? And with that comes stumbling and failing. And as the church, we forgive one another and come alongside one another as we walk in a fallen world with fallen hearts. Not only is it moralistic, but it's also therapeutic. What is therapeutic? Well, I think just in its normal sense, we have to say it's really to bring someone to a standard. That's actually what the word means when you talk about therapy. Having a beneficial effect on the body or mind, producing a useful or favorable result or effect. Just to give you an idea of what I mean by bring something to a standard. When you go to a physical therapist, the goal is to get whatever muscle or bone back to the standard. And once it's back to the standard, you no longer go to a physical therapist. If you go to an academic counselor, which functions the same way, the only reason you go to an academic counselor is because your grades are not meeting the standard, or maybe your mom's standard, whatever it is. And you have to then reach it and bring it to the next standard. Now, let me ask a question. That works for physical therapy, that works for academic therapy, that works even works for speech therapy. Once you get to a certain standard, you stop going. How does that work for mental therapy? What's the standard? How do you know when to stop going to therapy? It's an interesting question to think through, because now we're getting back to relativism. And I think this is a topic for another day, but I think that the people in that industry understand that immensely, because there is no definitive standard. And so you can just go indefinitely for the rest of your life. But if he really wanted to press in and ask, what is the standard? What does it mean to be in a healthy mental state? Go ask anybody walking around KSU's campus or anybody in your workplace, what is the standard for mental health? You know what the answer is? Their own happiness. That's it. Their own happiness. And so that's why you have people that stop going to therapy because they're finally happy, and they're right back 2 months later. Each person has their own goals. They have their own standards. They have their own expectations. Of course, we understand that this is different than biblical counseling because biblical counseling actually sets a standard. It's not a standard that's perfection, that's unreachable in the sense that, well, we're never going to reach there, so guess what? I got you booked for the next 10 years. But with biblical counseling, it's to bring their mind to renewal according to the scriptures. We want them thinking biblically, knowing that we will never reach a standard this side of heaven. The therapeutic label emphasizes the importance of feeling satisfied, fulfilled, and happy. Christian Smith says this in his book. He says that MTD is not a religion of repentance from sin. It's not a religion of living as a servant of a sovereign divine, or of steadfast saying one's prayers, or faithfully observing high holy days, or building character through suffering, or even basking in God's love or grace. MTD is not of spending oneself in gratitude and love for the cause of helping others. Because there's only one person at the forefront of your mind for MTD, and that's self. And I would say even there's a nuance of helping others is for the sake of how does that look upon me when I help others. Rather, what appears to be an actual dominant religion among U.S. teenagers is really, it's central all about feeling good, feeling happy, feeling secure, and feeling, I think this is a more common word today, feeling safe. We're just in a world where people will peel out of classrooms or work environments or touchy situations. And really the lingo we've learned to say today is, I just don't feel safe. How do you define that? And so many young people today are just dominated by this. Is therapy bad? Again, it depends on definitions. What are we talking about? We know that there's different types. So the question is, what's the goal? And for MTD, it's, again, happiness, peace, satisfaction. And I would define it again, MTD is about finding self-fulfillment with religion. And I would say that's the reason why they go to church. They go to church because they spent the entire week feeling really bad about all the sin they did, or how searching for happiness never actually got them to the point they wanted. And so what do? They go to church to make themselves feel better. Why do they change churches? Because this church doesn't make me feel good. The standards become self instead of God's word. And then lastly is deism. This is actually different than what I would say classic deism. Classic deism is the idea that there is a God, but he's completely uninvolved. He's taken the universe and wound it up like a clock and has set it on a shelf, and he's just watching with his bowl of popcorn. But this version of deism, again, it goes back, is more convenient for the MTD person. A deist is someone who believes in God, who created the world, but is uninvolved unless, here's the one stipulation, unless you need him. He will not intervene into your life unless you're in a dire situation, and then God will step in and fix your life for you. That's the way they think about it. It's not about, MTD is about a belief in a particular kind of God. This God is one that exists. He's created the world. He defines our general moral order. But not one who is particularly personally involved in one's affairs unless asked. And especially, we don't want him involved in our affairs when we'd prefer him not to show up. The idea of God disciplining his children or causing a divine providence in our life to keep us from sin is not in the vocabulary of an MTD person. This God is not demanding. He actually can't be, since his job is to solve our problems and to make people feel good. In short, God is something like a combination of a divine butler and a cosmic therapist. That's how they look at God. He's always on call. He takes care of any of our problems that arise, professionally helps his people to feel better about themselves, and does not become too personally involved in the process. Man, that sounds super convenient for someone that's chasing after their own sin. He's often described by teens as watching over everything from above and the creator of everything just up there controlling everything. That's phraseology that people said. In fact, one, a 15-year-old boy said this: God is like an entity that decides when or if he wants to intervene with a lot of things. This 15-year-old boy goes on to say, to me, God is pretty much like intervention, like extreme luck. Say you're $50 away from something and you find $50 on the floor. Then that's probably God's intervention or something like that. But other than that, it just seems like he's monitoring. He just kind of stays back and watches, like he's watching a play, like he's a producer. He makes the play all possible and then he watches it. And if there's something he doesn't like, he'll go in and change it. Such a puny view of God. And of course, we all know, is believing God exists enough? The answer is definitely no. Even the demons believe in God. It's more than head knowledge. In fact, I would say it's belief that's proven by action. The way you live reveals your theology. And for many people, including MTD people, I would say the way they live, they may say they believe in God, they may believe in a creator up there, but ultimately what's at the source of it is they're a practical atheist. Again, one 14-year-old Protestant girl from Colorado, from their study, said this: I believe there's a God, so sometimes when I'm in trouble or in danger, I'll start thinking about that, like the deistic God of the 18th century philosophers, the God of contemporary teenage moralistic therapeutic deism. She goes on to say that this God I pray to helps me when I need him the most, the way I want him to help me. This God is not demanding to the MTD. He can't be, because his job is to solve our problems. And so the different people who've written on this and have studied this and have done lots of surveys and different things, what they've done is they've pretty much taken everything they've read, everything that they've seen, and they've put it together into five doctrinal statements of the MTD. And so this is how an MTD person lives. These are the informal doctrinal creeds of a moralistic therapeutic deist. Number one, a God exists who created and ordered the world and watches over human life on earth. Number two, God wants people to be good, nice, and fair to each other as taught in the Bible and by most world religions. Number three, the central goal of life is to be happy and to feel good about oneself. Number four, God does not need to be particularly involved in one's life except when he is needed to resolve a problem. And then number five, which I think is pretty revealing, good people go to heaven when they die. Now remember, all this information just comes from just talking to young people that say they're a part of a faith. They say they're part of a religion, but the more you start asking them questions, this is what's actually coming out. And maybe it's just from a climate that we're in where it's all about unity and like-mindedness. But really, I think it's way more pathetic than that. It goes back to, I just think it's lazy human beings. Just absolutely lazy. They get up every day, and the moment they wake up, the first thought that comes to their mind is, how can I serve myself today? This is what you get. This is our Tower of Babel right here. Let's all get together. Kumbaya. Look, let's all just be fair and nice. You know, I know some of your other world religions do the same thing, so let's all agree on that. And if we're all good and nice, guess what? We all get to go to heaven. But I think number three, particularly, is this. I mean, it's the central point of this entire thing. In fact, so much so that when I was teaching the youth, I actually was trying to think about what this looks like. And this is what I ended up coming up with. This is what I think many young people today, particularly in, again, Western cultures, Western society, I think this summarizes MTD to perfection. I shouldn't say that because I made it up. Minor flaws. I think this is really what's driving it. Okay, so you've got a guardrail. So this is the road of life, the highway of life. And you've got one guardrail on one side, and that's your morals. Your morals are keeping you from crashing into the mountainside. Okay, you've got enough of a conscience. It's not completely seared yet. You still have a general belief in a God. So you're guarded on that side. But the general belief in God is on this side. There is a God that looks out for you. So that helps you from crashing and going off the cliff. But the center of it all is the road they're driving on, which is the therapeutic. And it's focused on goals, feelings, and happiness. And this is their every single day. They're driving on the road of their own feelings and happiness. And their morals and their God, their belief in general of a God, it's just pretty much the guardrails. And I would say for many people, it's equivalent to watching your four-year-old bowl, where it's just like they throw it, and it's just pinging off the walls as it's going down the road. I mean, but what happens is they're on this road, and they think the end of this road is paradise. But the end of this road is a cliff, an eternal cliff in separation from their Creator. And I would say, too, that the guardrails here, your morals and your belief in a God, this is probably the cleanest it looks. Because we all know the more you chase after happiness as a finite human being that is incapable of obtaining true happiness on this side of heaven, is something gives. And so you start contemplating, I don't know, maybe this is not the right road. No, I'm going to stay on it. And so you stay on it longer, and then other things happen in your life that you're not happy about. You know, you don't get the job you want. You don't get the girl or guy that you've been kind of looking at, or, you know, you don't have the amount of pay that you want. All these things that just wrestle in our own heart and discontentment. And so then you start looking at these guardrails and you're like, maybe that's what's restricting me. Maybe this is the thing that's actually keeping me from happiness. And so what you do, you start pushing those guardrails further out. And you start changing your morals. Maybe there's something that you believed was wrong when you were 17, but you get to 27, you're like, well, I mean, it's not that bad. Or maybe it's you start recognizing that maybe the God of the Bible is not it. Maybe there's more out there. And you start changing your definition of God. Is this not the case for the state of the human heart? As you continue to pursue your own selfish desires, the only end result is your morals slowly slide away. And essentially God slides away because you have become your own God and you have become your own definition of morals. And now you're just on a road with no guardrails. And unfortunately, many of us know people in our life that have gone off the rails, literally, with just how they have lived their lives because they continue to seek their own happiness first and foremost. So I wanted to end by just maybe addressing something that some of you may have in your mind, and that is, man, I've not heard of this, or I kind of heard a little bit of this, and like I just didn't realize that this was the state of our young people. Well, in some ways, it's like, let me calm your nerves. This is not like all hands on deck. Everybody study this book because we got to help our... No, nothing's changed. Nothing's changed. We don't have to come up with a new methodology. And in fact, the whole point of the study is not for you to be like, man, now I feel better equipped. No, we have everything we need for life and godliness right here. But this is to wake us up to the reality that we're living in right now. This is the state of young people today and how they're thinking. And I would say that none of this has changed because specifically 2 Timothy 3. Paul, in his last letter, "But know this, that in the last days, difficult times will come, for men will be lovers of self, lovers of money, boastful, arrogant, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, ungrateful, unholy, unloving, irreconcilable, malicious gossips, without self-control." I mean, have we not just been describing this the entire time? "They're without gentleness, without love for good, treacherous, reckless, conceited, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. Holding to a form of godliness, but having denied its power." That's moralistic therapeutic deism. They hold to a form of godliness because they've got good morals, because they've got good goals that they're pursuing. And if you were to ask them about God, they could tell you all about the God they worship. But by serving self, they deny its power. Paul says to keep away from such men. He says that they actually enter into the family dynamic and they take captive weak people that are weighed down by their sins to use them to their own advantage. And then in verse 7 in that chapter, he says that these people are always learning and never able to come to the full knowledge of truth. They go to Sunday school. They go to church. They listen to podcasts. Always learning, but never coming to the full knowledge of truth. So what's the solution? I've alluded to it multiple times, but I think it's just as simple as Matthew 16. This is the solution. It's always been this way. It's nothing new. Jesus said to his disciples, "If anyone wishes to come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. For whoever wishes to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul? Or what will a man give in exchange for his soul?" That's what MTD people need to hear. That's what we need to hear on a day-to-day basis. If we really got what we wanted and we really pursued and kept on going down our road of therapeutic happiness, is it worth your soul? The problem is many people are deceived into thinking that you can have both. I can get what I want and also be right with God. But Jesus says to deny yourself, to take up your cross and to follow him. This is a daily sacrifice, daily denying yourself, always looking to your own mind and your own heart, knowing that it is so deceived, it is so wicked, which is why we have the church, to come alongside one another, to help us either one, get back into the lane that we're supposed to be in, but for many of us, hey, get off that road. Literally turn around, repent, and come to know the Lord for the first time. And so this is what our young people need to hear. And so you guys can always be praying for me, praying for the youth and college ministry, because these are things that are constantly on my mind, because one day I will be held accountable and given account for every soul that has stepped foot into those ministries. But I'm so thankful for many parents in this room that are doing infinitely more work at home than what I have the opportunity to do on a Wednesday or Thursday night. So I want to say thank you so much for the work that you're doing. And as always, we want to pray that the Lord's will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Let's pray.